Well, great to see you, and welcome to Christian Heritage, to the Round Church. If you've not been here before, do have a look around afterwards. And this evening's one of the lectures that we like to put on and try and commend Christianity and make us think. This evening, Ellis Potter is coming to speak to us. Ellis was originally from California, as is fairly well known, a Buddhist monk who then became a Christian and worked for Le Brie Fellowship, which is a Christian study centre in Switzerland, for a number of years, and has particularly been interested in work in Eastern Europe, where he's been teaching and lecturing. And terrific to have you this evening.
Thank you.
Lovely to have you for the whole weekend, really. And Ellis will be speaking for about 40-odd minutes. Time for questions afterwards. Is art a commodity or a relationship? Ellis.
Thank you very much. It really is a privilege and a pleasure to be here in this ancient seat of learning and Christianity. I thank you very much for the invitation. I'm really honored and a bit daunted. I would like just to give a few simple ideas about how we relate to art. I am not an artist. I'm not going to tell you how to do art. I wouldn't be able to do that. I just want to explore some ideas about relating to art. Because all of us are confronted with art in various forms. We hear music, we see paintings, we see buildings, we read literature, poetry, advertising, we watch cinema and television. There are many forms of art, and we are constantly in contact with them. And so it is a large part of the life of everybody. And it's worthwhile thinking about it. How should we understand it? How should we relate to it? What is a good way of having contact with art? So the name of the lecture, as Ian said, is a question: is art a commodity or a relationship? That means, is art something commercial that we buy or possess or use or take in or consume? Or is art a human relationship in which we engage? So that's a very large question because they're very different things. The first possibility of art as a commodity is centered on me. It's centered on the self. What do I like? What is good for me? What will be of benefit to me if I consume it? What will give me pleasure? What will edify me? But the relationship, the second, is other-centered, which is my understanding of what love is. Now, mostly, I'm going to be talking about how should Christians relate to the arts. I don't know most of you. Maybe some of you are not Christians. I'm always thrilled to meet non-Christians. Often they tend to be a bit more interesting than Christians. but also I'm thrilled to meet them just because they're human beings and my neighbors. And I am under a mandate to love my neighbors. And so it's a really brilliant exercise and reality to meet non-Christians. So I'm glad if some of you are not Christians. I don't mean I'm glad that you're not Christians, but I mean that I'm glad if you're not Christians and you've come here to be together with us this evening. But mostly I want to talk about how Christians relate to the arts as children of God. The Bible is very clear, God is love. So if we are children of God, made in His image, we live in love. What does that mean as we relate to the arts. The first thing, perhaps, is to try to decide in some way what art is, what art means. When I'm teaching in schools, I always ask the students, please tell me, what is art? And there are many ideas. Art is a way of expressing. Art is being aware of my inner child. Art is pleasure. Art is stimulation. Just all different kinds of things that people come up with art. Or people think in terms of a specific form of art. Or a group of forms like the plastic arts, the visual arts, painting and sculpting and architecture and various graphic expressions of ideas in art. But then, when we begin to discuss it, the circle expands and it begins to include dance and poetry and cinema and cooking, cuisine art, the art of conversation, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger until it becomes very difficult to cope with art because it's so big. And so because it's so big and so difficult, we tend naturally to say, well, everybody knows what art is, which is the big avoidance of commitment and definition that we use in much of life. Well, everybody knows. And as soon as we say everybody knows, we know that that means nobody knows, because we're very strange. So I would like to offer you a definition of art with great timidity and a bit of fear, because when I offer this, it often causes a considerable period of rioting. People are not always really peacefully receiving this and entering into the spirit of the thing. But be patient, and I'll try to work it out a bit. Art, in my understanding, is deliberate human action. Now, sometimes people think that that definition is too large. But let me point out to you what it leaves out. Deliberate leaves out accident or something that happens to you by fate or chance. Some accidents have very happy results. So if you knock over the wine on the tablecloth, the stain on the tablecloth might be very interesting and stimulating and attractive. But in my definition, it's not art, because there is no responsibility involved. There is no real significance. It's not something that a human being has done. It's an accident. It's like the sunset or something that just happens. And it may be a happy result that we like. And then you might actually do art. You might cut out that part of the tablecloth and frame it and put it on the wall. Well, the cutting and the framing and the putting would be art. But the spilling by accident would not be art. Do you see the distinction? So it's deliberate. It's something that is responsible and significant. And it is human, which leaves out everything that God does. Now, that may seem blasphemous or unfair, but when we talk about art, we're really talking about what human beings do. So it leaves out the babbling brook and the beautiful forest and the sunset and the beautiful crystals and all the wonderfully beautiful things, and of course creative, because God is creative, that we find in the world that God has created. These are beautiful, and we should rejoice in them and be thankful for them and profit from them. But in my understanding, they are not art. Here is the big opposition in my understanding. Art, nature. That what is art is artificial. Not in the sense of phony or substitute or ersatz, but in the sense of arto facto, made by arm, from the Latin. Arto facto, an artifact. Arm is the basis of the word art. So it's something that someone does. And it's human. It's not natural. It's human, which in the biblical understanding of anthropology means miraculous, spiritual, involving the supernatural. What the human does is different from the birds making exactly the same nest year after year in the same tree, and the nest is very beautiful and interesting and stimulating, but it isn't art. It's only beautiful and interesting. It doesn't mean it doesn't have any value. It just means that it's not art, in my understanding. So deliberate and human, and then action. The word action leaves out pure imagination, dream, hallucination, pure thought and idea. It's something that is done. It's something that is filmed or painted or sculpted or danced or spoken or written or drawn. That art is action. Art is something that is done. And then in the plastic arts, the art leaves something behind. It leaves a residue, an evidence that art has happened, like a painting or a sculpting or a building. Then we have that, and we call it art, and it is art, but it's really the result of art. It's what art leaves behind after art has happened. Now, some people have urged me to include the word creative in this definition. Deliberate human creative action. And I really thought about that, and I've decided I want to leave it out. I understand the motivation, because people want art to be a very positive thing. But you see, we live in a fallen world, and there's evil, and there's sin, and there's death, and there's alienation and destruction. And that is part of the human existence in our present situation. And I want us to be realistic about that. So sin is art. If it's not art, it's not sin. If it's not art, it's a mistake. It may be something unfortunate, but it's a mistake. It's not a sin. Sin is something that is deliberate. Sin is something that you choose in self-centered rebellion. Sin is artistic. Sin isn't something that happens to you like the weather or your genetic structure. Sin is something that you choose, that you do. It's deliberate human action. So sin is art, and sin is uncreative. It's destructive. So I want to include destructive deliberate human action in my understanding of art, and not to say that if it's art, it's good, or sacred, or holy, or profitable. No, it might be art and be quite destructive and dangerous and negative. So, beginning with art and establishing this circle, which I think has to be very large, because if you make a definition, it means exactly that, define, to make a line around. And inside the circle is art, and outside of the circle is not art. And that's the usefulness of words. And we must be careful not to make the circle a dot. We're not frozen and paralyzed on the dot. The circle is a circle. It's a definite limitation. It's a form. And within that form and that limitation, there are infinite points. So if I would ask Ian, would you please bring me a cup of tea? He might bring me mint tea in a mug, Earl Grey tea with lemon in a cup and saucer. There are infinite points within the circle of cup of tea, but it will not be a banana. You see, that would definitely be outside of the circle. So when we talk about art or anything else, I think it's very useful to make a circle and to say, okay, here we are together. in the circle. But if everyone has their own circle, and we say, well, everyone knows what art is, or art is what you feel is art, or art is what you like, then we cannot be together. Everyone has their own circle, and there's just alienation and lostness, and we sort of, I talk to you like this, and I have no idea if you hear or care or anything. But if we will humble ourselves and to say, we need each other, we need to relate to each other, let's find a circle that we can live in together. And we might change, and the line around the circle might be pretty thick. And some people might say, well, this is inside and this is outside. And the next person might disagree in some of the details. But basically, we would be together in the discussion and in the relating to art and in living our lives. Another word is entertainment, which is so often connected to art, especially cinema and graphic arts and television, different motion, active arts, often are connected to the word entertainment. It comes also from the Latin intertenere, to be held between. So something that entertains is something that holds you between this deliberate and responsible part of your life and the next deliberate and responsible part of your life. And it's not evil. I think it's a gift from God to be entertained. When I look at the beautiful sunset, I am entertained. I don't have to make a responsible, critical evaluation of the sunset. I don't have to make deliberate decisions about the sunset. I don't have to make any kind of declaration or statement of faith about the sunset. I just look at it and I'm thrilled and pleased and strengthened and in wonder and awe because of the beauty of it. I am entertained. I'm held by the glory of God's creation. And this is therapeutic. This is a blessing. This adds and enlarges my life. And so it's a very good thing. But let me suggest that we should not approach art for entertainment, because art is a deliberate human action and it means something. It says something. We need to respond to it. We should avoid being entertained by art and be entertained by the kittens playing with the yarn on the carpet or by the squirrels in the tree. Be entertained by many things, but not by art. But instead, we should seek to be stimulated, challenged, confronted, questioned, informed, and many other things. Our relationship to art should be active, responsible, and interactive, and not passive and contentless, as in the case of entertainment. Again, I don't want to be negative about entertainment. I think entertainment is a blessing and a gift from God that we should receive and use and be thankful for, but we should not make art entertaining, because it is a deliberate human action and our response should respect it as such. Another word that's often involved in a discussion of art is taste. People say, am I supposed to like that? Oh, this is a very sad question. Am I supposed to like that? But you cannot organize your taste. You don't choose what you like. It happens to you like the weather. You meet 10 people at a meeting, and one of them you like the most, and one of them you like the least. You're not responsible for that. God isn't going to praise you for being most attracted to that person and condemn you for being least attracted to that person. It's something that happens to you, like the weather. But then the responsibility comes in and you choose how to relate and interact with those people. And if you totally avoid the one and you completely monopolize the time of the other, then you're responsible and you have done wrong. Then there's a problem. But the fact of liking one the most and one the least, your taste, is not responsible. It just happens to you. You just discover, oh, I like that the most. I'm attracted to blue. Well, blue is my favorite color. Are you going to praise me for that? And say, oh, what an honorable thing. Yes, Ellis's favorite color is blue. He must be a wonderful man. No, that's absolutely nonsense. It just happens to me. People say, I don't know anything about art, but I know what I like. And they say it as if after strenuous investigation and careful consideration, they have actually established what it is that they like, and that this is an honorable thing and an achievement in their life. But I'm not so sure that it's that valuable a thing to know what you like. I live in Switzerland, and it's an unwritten law that you have to grow red and white geraniums in your window boxes. And my wife and I do this, and the geraniums know what they like. They like sunshine, they like water, they like a little something to eat. And if they get what they like, they show you that they like it. They bloom and they flourish. How many of you bake bread? How many of you eat bread? Oh, good. Now we're in the same circle together. You probably know that to bake bread, you need yeast. And in order to bake bread, you have to know what yeast like. And they like moist and warm and sweet. And if you give them that, they're very happy and they multiply and the bread gets big. If you don't give them that, the bread is quite flat. So yeast know what they like. So when we have come to the point of knowing what we like, we have lifted ourselves to the level of one-celled asexual organisms, which is not really a great achievement considering that we are actually human beings. We are responsible and significant. And that should be the level of our understanding of ourselves. Not that I am like a yeast cell or a geranium and I know what I like. This is completely subhuman. All life forms know what they like. This is not a human project to know what you like. But we get caught in this kind of reductionism, this self-centered, consuming question of what do I like? And of course, this is reinforced with advertising because people sell the things that they want to sell by persuading you that you like it and that you need it and that you should like it. That the best people, the movers and shakers and the cool people, like this. And if you want to be cool, and of course, everybody needs to be cool, then you will like this, or at least you will pretend to like it. You will pretend that is your taste for the sake of coolness. Well, all of this is very dehumanizing, very reductionistic. And a part of what I want to say to you this evening is hang on to your humanness. Don't let yourself be reduced to the level of a yeast cell, but be a human being. Human beings are not only natural. We are spiritual, significant, rebellious. What we like is often bad and harmful. If that weren't true, we would never sin. We like sin. You see, if we didn't, we wouldn't do it. Why would you do it if you didn't like it? It's attractive. That's what temptation is. So we need to different ways of measuring value in art. And as we approach the arts, I think it's useful to make two confessions. And one is that I often like what is bad. There are, for instance, paintings and poems that are kitschy, trite, derivative, careless, without much going for them, and without a great deal of integrity and unity of form. They're just poor, and they're my favorite things in all the world. I just love them to pieces because my taste is not related directly to skill and excellence and nobility. I am a sinner. So I like what is bad because sometimes the bad things make me feel good about myself because I think, well, I could do better than that. And so then they're very precious to me. But the second confession that we need to make is that there are excellent, noble things that are really worthwhile and something we can learn from and be stimulated by with integrity of form and application and contextualization. And I really don't like them at all. They're just not my taste. So I think this humility will give us freedom to look at the art and ask, what is it? What does it say? What does it do? What does it mean? And how can I react to the actual content and meaning and humanness of the art, and not how can I decide whether to consume it or not? You see, that's just a mechanical, commercial way of relating to the world around us rather than a human, let alone godly way. In Exodus 31, the beginning of the chapter, we read that Bezalel was filled with the Spirit of God, the Holy Spirit, and was given spiritual gifts, skill, ability, and knowledge. And we know from the New Testament that the Holy Spirit gives gifts of wisdom, faith, miraculous powers, understanding other languages, prophecy, teaching, various gifts, but we often don't realize that skill, ability, and knowledge come from the Holy Spirit as well. These things do not come from the devil, although they can be misused and twisted by him, as can the other gifts. We should rejoice in these gifts, which we all have in some measure, and take responsibility for their exercise. As God is creative, and we are made in his image, so we have a biblical mandate for creativity. Art is life. Life is art. Deliberate human action is what we are about in our lives. And so we are all artists in this sense. Not in a specific school of art or field of art or media of art, but as living human beings, we are artists. And because we are, when we realize this and we accept this greatness and this responsibility, it helps us to be able to relate to people involved in the specific art forms, the painters and the musicians and the filmmakers. Christian parents often ask me, what kinds of films should I let my children watch? What kind of music should I let my children listen to? And these questions are asked in love. They are motivated by concern for the edification and protection of the children. But there is a disturbing limitation and underlying assumption in these questions, and that is that art is a commodity that we consume. These questions, what films should my children watch, what music should my children listen to, are questions of diet. What can my children consume that will be edifying for them? And the center of the question is the child. But love is other-centered. And we shouldn't be so much teaching our children to protect themselves and to avoid difficulties or controversy in life, but teaching them to love, which is the greatest protection a against evil, teaching them to be other-centered. Now, of course, there are films particularly, but also music and poetry, that are unintelligible to some ages of childhood. So if you have a book about teenagers falling in love and being jealous and all these kinds of hormonal considerations in a novel, to a seven-year-old, this is totally boring nonsense. And so it would not be appropriate at all for them to read that. It would just be confusing and strange, or a film on such subjects. And so as parents, we should be wise to realize what is the stage of development and the appropriate areas of interest and understanding for the children, and parents have a responsibility to guide the children in this way. Having said that, the whole responsibility is not to protect our children, but to equip our children. And I would say it would be a step better than asking, what kinds of movies should I let my children watch, to ask, what kinds of movies should I watch with my children? That would be a big step in the right direction. Because we can have a discussion about it, and I can ask my children, who was the hero? Who was the villain? What are the values? What are people hoping for in this film? Is this what you hope for? Is this what Jesus hopes for? And there can be a real understanding, an enjoyment of, oh, wasn't it fun? Wasn't it exciting? Wasn't it thrilling and beautiful? However, the values in the film might be very unbiblical values. And then we can help our children to discern and to realize, well, I enjoy the film, I appreciate the skill and the technique, but I say no to some of the values. I am free to disagree. I don't just eat or not eat. I actually relate. See, we reduce ourselves to a kind of a binary reality. 1-0, like a computer. On, off. Or I like to say that we relate to the arts in two ways, or which is a bit primitive, you see, but that's how we are. So often when I mention, particularly to younger people, that I've seen a film, the first question is, how did you like it? Well, now think about that question. That is a yeast cell question. How did I like it? Well, I liked it viscerally. I liked it emotionally. I liked it... how did I like it? The question is about me. The question is not, what was the film about? What did the film say? What were the values in the film? Nothing about the film, only about me. And you see, this is our natural, sinful tendency to concentrate on ourselves and to be, as the serpent said, like God, knowing good and evil from ourselves, according to our own reaction, our own response, our own awareness, rather than having external criteria in larger circles where we can be together. For instance, together in the Word of God. In the Bible, that's a place where we can be together. Those are categories that we can share. But it's very difficult for me to share my taste. How did you like it? So I just have to say, well, ah. And then they might say, oh, ah, me too. And so then we have this experience that we're together in ah-ness. Or, and what about this film? Me too. But then sometimes there's conflict, and I say, ah, and they say, Well, then we just move right on to another film, so we can ah or together. Well, this is very primitive and reductionistic, but I think you can recognize that this is actually what we do in relating to the arts. And Christians should be leading, guiding lights in getting out of this prison of naturalistic reductionism into the glories of true human life made in the image of God. fearfully and wonderfully made. Andy Warhol could see that the American people wanted art to be product, so he painted a Campbell's tomato soup can. It was a great insult to the American people, but they loved it. And Andy Warhol cried all the way to the bank. He made a lot of money off of it. If art is only products to be produced and consumed, then we can rightly be self-centered and protective in our approach to it. But art is really expressions in various languages of observations, questions, complaints, admiration, challenges, and encouragements made by human beings as part of a great conversation with the cosmos, with God, and with other people. If human expression in the arts and in every way is only product to be consumed, then as Christians, or perhaps as anybody, we should never have a conversation with an alcoholic, a drug addict, a homosexual, or a prostitute, because their conversation will almost certainly not be edifying. And we don't want to consume it. Their conversation will be art, but if art is product, we say, no, I don't hear this. I don't consume this. But Jesus spent most of his time with this sort of people because he knew who they really were, fearfully and wonderfully made in the image of God. And so we can see clearly that to say, no, I would never have a conversation with a troubled person or a confused person or a person with a dangerously wrong idea because I wouldn't want to consume that conversation. That's the same as saying, no, I will never see a Woody Allen film, or I will never look at a Picasso, because it won't be edifying. It's the same kind of dehumanizing, commercializing attitude on both sides. And what I'm recommending is that we don't live by a self-protecting commodification of the people around us and their expressions. And Woody Allen is our neighbor, but that we live by love, and that we become more other-centered and listening and being aware. Not that we say yes to everything, but that we know more clearly what we say no to, and that we have something to say in response to someone who says something that is confused or wrong or dangerous or mistaken or painful, or ugly, or demanding. The Bible records that Jesus taught us we must become like little children in order to get into the kingdom of heaven, in order to belong with God. And it means that if you don't become like a little child and you sneak into the kingdom of heaven, you won't like it there, because that's what it's like. It's like little children. Some Christians think that having faith like a little child means not asking questions. Just have faith like a little child. Don't ask questions. Don't muddy the waters. Just believe. Just have faith like a little child. How many of you have ever seen a little child that didn't ask questions? I say, it's completely absurd. That's their job. That's what they do all day long. That's the whole profession of childhood is asking questions until the adults are just wild. Repeated questions, nonsense questions, embarrassing questions, shocking questions, revealing questions, all manner of difficult questions. That's the job of the child, to ask these questions. Children have the courage to ask deep, disturbing, even outrageous questions because they have faith. It's quite the opposite. If you do have faith, you will ask questions. If you don't ask questions, it means your faith is weak. It's the opposite of what people like to say. They have faith in their parents, who they believe to be omniscient for several years of their lives. They have faith in God. They have faith in the world around them to supply reasonable and useful answers. They have faith that reality is going to fit together in a cohesive whole. And because of that faith, they dare to ask anything. And they dare to experiment with anything. And at a young age, everything goes in the mouth. What is this? Oh, worm. Very interesting. It's a very scientific young children. Lots of experimentation. But then, children find out that mommy and daddy don't know everything. I was working in Switzerland with a colleague in the garden, and his three-year-old boy came to him with a worm that was broken in half and said, "Daddy, fix." Well, now that's faith, you see. That's normal in a healthy childhood. Daddy can do anything. Daddy fixes everything. That's what he does. Here's a broken worm. Daddy, fix. Well, then the father had to say, "No, I cannot fix." And you could see his whole world changed. There's something daddy cannot do. And there was a growing up process that was not pain-free that began in this boy. So we are disappointed. People fail us. People lie to us. We have all kinds of painful experiences with asking questions. And so when there is the betrayal and the dishonesty and the unreliability of a fallen world, then we begin to close down and we don't ask the questions, or we ask dishonest questions or leading questions or manipulative questions or self-aggrandizing questions. And we call this process maturity and sophistication. You see, but actually it's a process of dying. But because we live in a world that is covered with the dust of death, and we are dying, and we don't want to really face reality, then we put a smiley face on this death, and we honor it, and we say, "Oh yes, this is maturation. This is becoming an adult. This is becoming sophisticated." And actually, it's death. It's the death of faith, the death of trust, the death of honesty, the death of courage. It's a shrinking of the person. And Jesus came and died that we would have our childlike life back again. This is what he wants us to have. And so he says very clearly, if you don't become like a little child, which I have come to bring you, to restore you to your childlike life, if you don't accept this to be a little child of God, you won't be in the kingdom of heaven, because that's what it's like. Little children are excited about everything and asking about everything. Ooh, ah, and ah, a bird nest, oh, everything. Well, the kingdom of heaven is ah. And we lose that. We lose that because of sin, our own sin, and the effects of the sins of the people around us. And we shrink and harden and get this hard shell around us and get stony hearts. And Jesus came that we would have new hearts and new lives, so that we would be flesh and touchable and able to reach out and touch and relate in faith and trust to people, to the reality around us. Little children test their subjective concept of the world against the objective reality around them. For example, a child might crawl under a low table and decide, "Now I will stand up." And so they do, and then they crash their head against the underside of the table. Oh, this is very strange. Something is impeding my concept development here, and this is very upsetting. And so they try again, harder. And then they begin to cry. Not really in pain, but in anger. and frustration because their concept cannot be realized in objective reality. The child must either submit to the form of the table and the world, or he will crack his head open and die. And that is our situation as humans and as artists. There are limits. Total freedom equals death. And total freedom is advertised, free to be me. This is a great value. This is one of the added commandments of the late 20th and early 21st century. Thou shalt be free to be you. Thou shalt go with the flow. Thou shalt let it all hang out. Thou shalt get in touch with thy feelings. All of these commandments that we have, and the first, of course, the very first commandment that we obey, thou shalt avoid pain. Now that's something children don't know about. How many times a day do children laugh? How many times a day do children cry? They don't avoid pain. They rush into life. They live exciting, dangerous lives. And they're crying and laughing. Their lives are very intense. And I think that's what God has for us, to live intense lives, engaged lives, childlike lives. We are all in such a position morally in relation to God's reality. We are allowed to discover the limits, but if we do not respect them, we will die. We can be thankful and rejoice in the fact that our God supplies us a stable and faithful basis against which to test ourselves and with whom to have an eternal, meaningful, life-giving relationship. Creativity must not be our God. We must not worship our creativity or the creativity of others. We must worship God alone. Non-Christians, finally, have no reason or purpose to be creative, as Christians do have such a reason and a purpose. Non-Christian creativity is often from a kind of a frantic energy in the search for meaning and purpose. The Christian has meaning and purpose from God through Christ. And because of that, the Christians should be more creative because we have a God and a personal Savior to thank, to glorify, and to obey. Non-Christian creativity produces many interesting, stimulating, and pleasing things because the creativity in itself is right, not wrong. It is looking to creativity for a source of meaning and purpose and identity, which comes from the human beings themselves, that is wrong. It is also the non-creativity of the Christians which is wrong and disobedient. When we do not obey God in being creative, it is basically because we don't have faith in Him to sustain us in the struggle and the process. Last night I was preaching about spirituality, and I was saying that the spiritual life is the larger life and the unspiritual life is the smaller life, and that the smaller life doesn't disappear when we become spiritual, but it's completed. It's brought into a total focus of reality when we become more spiritual. But imagine if you would go out into Cambridge and stop 10 people at random and ask them a question and tell them, I promise I will not sell you anything. I just want the answer to this question. And the question is this: if you would become a Christian today, do you think your life would become larger, fuller, richer, more involved with the people and the circumstances around you? Or do you think your life would be smaller, narrower, more withdrawn, less involved with the people around you. What do you think their answer would be? Probably smaller. So then if we realize that probably is their understanding of Christianity, and we who are Christians know that that is a wrong understanding, why do they have that wrong understanding? Who taught them that about Christianity? Did we teach them that? In some ways, yes, probably we did. Well, then shame on us. Can we stop teaching them that? Can we start teaching them the truth that Christianity is a larger life than the non-Christian life, a more fully life than the non-Christian life? Is it possible for us to become like little children and live lives that are actually salt and light? We are to be the salt of the earth, not the salt of heaven. We are to be the light of the world, not the light of the sky. We are not supposed to gather together to shine on each other, but to go out into the world to shine in the darkness and to flavor and preserve the rotting culture around us. Jesus said that he came to give us life, that we might have life, and that we might have it tidily. Some of you are shaking your heads. No, he said that we would have life and have it abundantly. But we don't want to accept that because it's not safe. The abundant life is not safe. You have to live the abundant life by faith. You can live the tidy life by sight. Looks good. It's all very tidy. You can see the whole thing. And if you make life really small, you can keep it clean very easily. See, then that's very lovely. It's very attractive. But it doesn't seem to be what Jesus was talking about, life, abundant life. Oh, we read in the Old Testament, in Psalm 23, my cup runs over. And what is our reaction? What a mess. Let's clean this up. I don't want any running over in my life. It's just by categorically, it means out of control. If my life runs over, it's out of control. It's certainly out of my control. It's not out of God's control. But when my cup runs over, it's unpredictable. It's unsafe. It's in some ways uncomfortable. It's increasing riches of life and increasing complications of life, increasing variables of life, lack of control of life, increasing beauty and engagement when my cup runs over. But because I am a sinner, I do not want that. That is not my taste. That is God's taste. Well, whose taste is correct in this reality, my taste or God's taste? That's a very difficult question. No, and when we sin, of course, we say, well, my taste, of course, is the real, truly good taste and the accurate taste and the appropriate taste. And God, well, maybe later. But we center on ourselves. Perhaps we should encourage each other to learn something of the various languages of the arts and to ask questions about them. Perhaps we should try to read the questions that painters, filmmakers, writers, poets, musicians, sculptors, and dancers and architects are asking. We know that Jesus is the answer. We need to love our neighbors enough to understand what questions they are asking. So let me stop there and open it up to questions and discussion. That's often more valuable because then I'm more sure I'm connecting with you. Does anyone want to ask anything or explore one of the little areas that... Yes, Pete.
When you say that do our lives become smaller or larger when we become Christians, there's probably a lot of Christians might find, the people that become Christians, they might find that they lose a lot of the friends and family, perhaps even, you know, the pastimes that they had, you know, before they became Christians. And they find they have lost an awful lot. Perhaps that is, you know, something that they do need, that would either be inevitable or that they need to do. But then they are sort of gaining. I think it's a trade-off between sort of what's something that you. What's that quote? It's no fool who gives up what you can't keep to gain what you can't lose. You would experience that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the question is about when people become Christians, they lose friends and are alienated from families, and in some sense their life gets smaller. They do have to give something up. And that does happen. I think it could be minimalized. I think sometimes it happens because when people become Christians, their life does become smaller. They become institutionalized. They equate relating with Jesus Christ to functioning within a subculture. And then the people around them are not interested and say, well, I certainly won't go with you into that subculture. And I think it's important to remember that God made us human before he made us Christians. And so on the level of humanness, we have a great commonality with everybody. And we tend to lose that in our institutionalizing and subculturalizing and fortress mentality of wall building in the Christian life. And that can contribute to being alienated from family and friends, because we become Christians and then we stop relating to them as human beings. But I think we should be teaching and encouraging each other. When you become Christian, you don't become unhuman or superhuman. You remain human as Christians and are even more human. Your life doesn't shrink and become compartmentalized. Your life expands. And so many of the ways that you have been relating to family and friends and colleagues remain and should become contextualized and beautified by the love of Jesus Christ, and not isolated and alienated through saying, well, you're going to hell and I am not, although that is true. That is true. It's not a good conversation starter. It's not a good way to develop a relationship to say that. And I think this contributes to this shrinkage that you're quite right, we do experience. Have I addressed your question, or did I wander off?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. You have to be careful with me, because I hear a question and then I go where I want and you need to call me back.
It's a question about, you described art as the action, and in the plastic arts, something is left behind. And if we're to understand art as a relationship, how are we to relate to the art rather than that which is left behind, which is maybe more tempting to view as a commodity?
Yes. Well, I think we need to see in what's left behind the ideas of the action, the meaning, the purpose, the direction, the question, the statement, the hope, the fear, whatever was in the activity, the meaning of it, we need to try to find it in what is left behind. And we won't find it exactly, but there's bound to be a strong connection between what is left and what was done. So if a painter paints people, and some of the people are very large and some of the people are very small, well, this says something. Or some of the people are very far away and some of the people are very near. Some of the people are at the top of the painting and some of the people are at the bottom of the painting. This says something about how they view the world and how they hope or fear or want to relate. And so we can read in the painting, even in abstract paintings, we can read relationships and rhythm and structure and flows and these kinds of things. What is being said? What kind of a world is being shown? What kind of a thought form? What kind of a Weltanschauung? What kind of a worldview is being expressed in this painting or this music or this dance? And of course, music is played and then it's gone in the air, but it's also written down. And so you can go and look at it and say, whoa, you can see Trinitarian elements or chaotic elements or aleatory chance elements. You see whole worlds in the music. There are lots of people who think that music doesn't say anything, that it's just there and you like it or you don't like it, and then it's gone and it's something that you take on board or you don't take on board, and that has nothing to say. But this is very, very wrong. It has very much to say. It expresses worldview. And we need to be very careful, parenthetically, how we connect music, which says something, with words that say something also, and to try to make them say the same thing. So if you sing about the crucifixion and you sing lullaby, everything is all right music, there's a conflict there. They don't support each other, the music and the... Or you need to have a very good reason for it. Well, when you see these things, then you read what was behind it. Is that what you meant? Okay. Good. Yes.
You made a division between Christian and non-Christian art. I'm not sure that I agree with that.
Between Christian and non-Christian art? I don't agree with making that kind of division either.
Right. Mm-mm. But I think you said the Christian has a meaning and the non-Christian doesn't, so art would be different.
No, I didn't mean that the result would look different, but that the motivation is different. The reason for making the art is different for the Christian and the non-Christian. The humanness is the same, but the reception of the gift, the worship, the thankfulness is there for the Christian, but not for the non-Christian. But looking at it, you might not be able to tell the difference. You might, of course, for various reasons, but you might not. For instance, if a Christian and a non-Christian go into a kitchen and boil an egg, and then the two eggs are brought to you, and you're supposed to choose the Christian egg, it would be very difficult. You know, it would be quite remarkable if you could do that. Because water boils at 100 degrees Celsius at sea level for the Christian and the non-Christian. The rain falls on the just and on the unjust. So there's a lot in common that we have, more in common in some senses than there are differences.
Yeah, I just thought, I mean, a Christian might paint very depressing pictures because that's what they're working through.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah. And a non-Christian might paint constantly hopeful, cheerful, tra-la-la paintings all the time just as a therapy and not as a reality, but just saying, well, I imagine this reality and I just proclaim that this is how reality is. Everything is happy, happy. Well, if a Christian does that, which happens sometimes, I think there's a theological problem. Because that's not how reality is. It's fallen. There's death. There's sickness. There's alienation. There's confusion. And that a Christian should not avoid those realities and to say, here we are with all these problems and all these difficulties, and the Lord is with us, and He keeps us. And we walk by faith, and we live in hope. But the reality is painful. Now, yes.
Because I think you said that, you know, Christians should be more creative, and that's what occurred. Why are there so very, very, very few Christians in the arts at an international level, or even local level?
Yes, I think Christians get saved, and in a real way, the struggle is over. We rest in the Lord. But we rest too deeply. We go to sleep. And I think that is a main problem. And we really do rest in the Lord, and in a very real sense, the struggle is over. Whereas the non-Christians are out there fighting for identity and reality and creating and moving and looking and frantic and full of energy and desperation. And the Christians are at peace. So there's going to be that difference. That's not wrong. I think that's right. But the peace that the Christians have shouldn't be a sleepy peace. It should be an energetic, rejoicing, entering into the battle. Shalom, not the peace of sleep or the peace of death, but the peace of well-being and the foundation of standing on the rock so I can fight my fight and walk my walk. But we have a natural tendency to go to sleep. We have a natural tendency to rest in the Lord. And that's not what it means. It means to rest my feet on the rock, who is Christ, and then live my life and do my activities. And we maybe need a bit more teaching about this. Also, when people are creative and active in these ways, they're not safe. They're not cozy. And the Christian zoo is full of bunny rabbits, but there are no lions. And that's our natural tendency. But we're not supposed to be natural. We're supposed to be spiritual. And I think one of the reasons there are so few Christians is because we're sinners and we're lazy and we're unfaithful. There are some great Christian artists. I'm not a visual artist. I'm a musician, so I'm more aware of what might be happening. And there are world-famous musicians who are acclaimed by secular critics and really valued in the world, making statements that are not always very well understood, but are clearly biblical, scriptural statements. I think of Arvo Pärt or Krzysztof Penderecki, who is a Christian and is the only composer ever invited by the world to write music. He wrote the celebration music for the 25th anniversary of the United Nations. It was performed in New York. And he called it cosmogonia, the study of the cosmos, the history of the cosmos. This is great, great work, and nobody knows it. There's great Christian art, but Christians are not interested in it because it's challenging. It's not sleepy stuff. It's very challenging. And we want lullabies. Or we want art that is just a reflection of the culture around us so that it's relevant. And because of this, the world is the salt and the light of the church. And that's not how Jesus said it. He said, you are to be the salt and the light of the world. You are to be the cutting edge, the leading light, pointing into the future, inventing the genre, showing the way. But we're disobedient in this. And so the world does its thing, and then 5 or 10 years later, we baptize it. And we bring it in, and we say, my, aren't we relevant? And we're being salted and lit up by the world, by the world spirit. And we really should be making a difference. We shouldn't be just like the world. We should be different, exciting, interesting, a real alternative to the world, the Christian community and the Christian creativity. But it's not safe. And it's difficult to find churches and groups of Christians who will support creative people, because they're not understood. They speak a language that not everybody knows. Not everybody speaks music. Not everybody speaks visual things. So it's very difficult. And that's why such a meeting like this is so important, because we can begin to see, well, we should make an effort, we should support, we should become more aware, we should make our saltiness saltier, and we should make the light brighter for the world. We as Christians and those who are particularly gifted and called and enthusiastic about these things, we should be supporting them. And of course it's dangerous, but to some extent there needs to be a bit of trust. We can't expect to understand what the really creative and artistic people are doing all the time, because it's going to be exactly creative. It's going to be a new song or something that is not just a standard, recognizable, oh yes, I know that, I like it because I know it, but I don't know that. I don't know how that works. I don't know how that language fits together. You have to really become like a little child in order to relate to new things like that. And that is where we get sophisticated and sleepy and dead. Yes?
This is a bit of a question about whether you're idealizing of it already and whether perhaps we might need a little bit of bringing down to earth, because with your definition on your circle going so wide, or your definition so broad, presumably, given that you're allowing I need to rest so as to work, and given you're allowing that's a gift from God, if I'm going to watch a slightly arbitrary, pointless comedy program on TV, and if you're going to call that art because all human action is art, or if someone's going to drop something on purpose and that will be a deliberate human action and will therefore be art, presumably I'm not going then to react to all art in the same way or to the same extent or with the same depth of questioning. And so if that's the case, perhaps some distinctions need to be drawn still within the picture.
Oh, exactly right. Exactly right. The circle is very big. And then within this larger circle of art, we have folk art, academic art, various centuries of art, various cultures of art, various media of art. We make subdivisions within it. But if we take one or a small group of those subdivisions and we say this is art and the rest of deliberate human action is not art, it's very difficult to have a consensus about where that subdivision is. And the reason I'm offering this really huge definition is because we can really share it. It's a starting point for all of us. Okay, here we are. Now we begin to subdivide, but the subdivisions are not normative. They're not absolute. They're flexible. They're not in stone. And that gives a freedom.
Okay, so if I can come back on that. Then, to come to the part of that question, which is kind of rather bringing it down to earth, most of the art that we will encounter in our everyday lives will not be of the sort where we will engage with enormous concentration or intellectual activity in order to understand and divine the meaning behind it. So, if I liked your introduction, if you think that buildings, for example, are artifacts or the resonances of art, one of the most often that we encounter, or television programs, or idol conversation, let's say, then how, as Christians, should we express the attitude that you are trying to exhort us to express in these more general encounters with art in our everyday life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that we can become more awake, more rigorous, more curious, more demanding, more encouraging to the people around us, so that when people speak in a way that is so casual that it begins not to have any meaning or any commitment, then we can ask, are you saying this or are you saying that? We can stimulate, we can confront, we can invite, we can be salt and light, we can hope, we can work for a greater humanness in deliberate human action, because the general tendency is sort of entropy, if things just cool down and just flow around and everything. But I think the job of the Christian is to say, well, wait a minute, no, let's be human, let's stimulate each other, let's be awake, wake up, that this is how Christians can really be a blessing to each other and to the non-Christian world around them. Just by saying, no, we are alive, awake in Christ, and let's live like that. Let's be sensitive, let's be aware, let's be intense. I mean, you can't be intense all the time, you just exhaust yourself. So you have to rest, and you need entertainment. But I really like to make the distinction between entertainment and art, that if something is entertaining, it's not really saying anything. It's just therapeutic and beautiful or stimulating, but it doesn't require any response. It doesn't require any discussion or evaluation. It's just there. And it's not wrong, but it's not art. The art is engaging. So not everything that we confront is art. Some is accidents, some is entertainment, these different kinds of things. But I think we should try to be really artistic in our lives. And so as Christians, we should cook interestingly, dress interestingly, speak interestingly, read interesting things, engage in interesting conversations with people, and be salt and light, and really lead the culture into a greater reality which God wants for everybody.
I'm changing the subject, is that okay?
Yes.
I'm thinking about your definition of art. I noticed that you said that it's deliberate human action which leaves out accident and chance, and it also leaves out pure thought, imagination, idea, and dream. What I'm thinking is that actually there are two stages in this process. The one which is the final one, which is the action, which is made. But in the process, in the actual creative process, you do use very often chance and accident and use it. And so in doing thought, pure thought, imagination, idea and dream is very, very often part of the creative process. So I just wanted to comment on the fact that I think there are two parts.
I think that's very valuable, that there is pure thought, intuition, insight, light bulbs going on, aha moments, these kinds of things, which are not particularly deliberate or linear, that are involved and necessarily involved, but they're not responsible. We're not responsible for those things. I'm not responsible for my aha experiences. They happen to me, and I need them. They need to happen to me. They're not something that I can choose. Okay, now I'm going to look at an elm tree and I'm going to have an aha experience. I can't produce that.
I can see what you're saying, but I do think there's a responsibility there as well. It's one which takes place at a much deeper level. It's at the level even of a deep unconscious sometimes, and one can actually, to some extent, one can stimulate that by where one lives, where one's living.
Yes. Yes, by the circumstances in which we put ourselves, we're more liable to one kind of thing happening to us or to another. So yes, there is a responsibility. If I live in a neighborhood where there's a tremendous amount of noise pollution and flashing lights and constant billboards and electric signs and everything, my dreams and my thought life are going to be affected by it. If I don't take time to be quiet, and that is a deliberate choice, and that has results. Thank you very much. That's very, very important to realize that we make circumstantial choices that affect our deliberate human actions later on.
I'm coming from a position of an artist, so it's experimental. Yeah.
Yes.
And I'm coming from
that. And I know that artists and scientists have these moments of insight, and these, and composers, Mozart, etc., have these thought processes that are really not linear, and and not analyzable in the way that we normally do in our conscious waking state. And while recognizing that, I think that there is a limitation to our responsibility for some of those things happening, because some of them just happen to us. They just come. And no one is going to blame me for those things coming to me, and no one should praise me really either. For I should say, well, no, it's not really my honor that that happened to me. It did happen to me. Now, that I pursued it is my choice, and that I developed it is my choice. And then that's where it comes directly into the deliberate human action.